Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
So thank you very much for that introduction. You might notice that the title of my presentation has altered slightly. So it's no longer communication technology, but it's now more particularly social media. So I'm going to be looking at social media and the potential democratizing effect that social media is having on international criminal justice. I present this paper on behalf of myself and my colleague, Joanna Makayova, who couldn't be here today. And I'd also like to quickly acknowledge the research assistant of the graduate student sitting in the back there. It's also very knowledgeable about this subject. Now, I'm particularly happy to be here to talk about this today because I think that social media is playing a very increasingly important role in conflict and international criminal justice generally. It's been a really fascinating exercise to look into this phenomenon of social media use in conflict. I must say, this is very much a work in progress, and as such, your thoughts and feedback are particularly welcome if you have any thoughts at the end. Now, in our paper, we set out to explore this idea that social media is having a democratizing effect on international criminal justice. Now, our theory is basically as follows. That the use of social media in conflict is leading to a shift in the power dynamics in international criminal justice. By giving people on the ground a greater voice, social media allows them to have a greater say over the direction of international criminal justice and allows people to participate in ICJ in a way that they couldn't do before. In this sense, the paper conceptualizes the people, so to speak, as an actor external to international criminal justice and an actor which has an influence and power over it. And because there's this diffusion of power away from a centralized figure to a much broader base of people, I think that the lens of democratization here is quite useful and valuable. Now, it's framed here as a theory, and I've done that deliberately. At the moment, the aim of the paper is to set up a conceptual and theoretical framework through which to examine this phenomenon. And in terms of sort of concrete data, we haven't reached that stage in the paper yet. So that's the direction that we're moving to next, or to establish this theoretical framework. Now, many of us have an intuitive grasp of what social media is, or at the very least, we can name one or two or three of the sites that are on the slide. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube. In this professional context, LinkedIn becomes quite important. But actually, defining social media in a more concrete way is very challenging. If for no other reason that every single day there seems to be a new social media platform for us to learn about news, and every day other social media platforms fall into disuse. Luckily, for the purposes of today, I'm not going to attempt to give you a definition of social media, because it's not necessary. I'll just point out some characteristics of social media that are particularly relevant to the argument. Firstly, that social media is open access, in the sense that any of us with access to the internet and to the relevant hardware, whether it be a smartphone or a laptop, can go onto a social media platform and sign up and become a user. The second characteristic is that social media content, once it's up there, is generally speaking accessible to all other users. Now, of course, if you think about things like Facebook, maybe not all of your photos are accessible to everybody. On the other hand, Twitter and YouTube, these are platforms that are open. So you can go and look at anybody else's content. And the third characteristic, which is particularly important, is that social media is a two-way form of communication. So just as I can go onto Twitter and read what many of my fellow conference attendees are writing about the conference, I can also upload material myself. So I can disseminate content and I can take in content equally. It's a two-way form of communication. Now we use social media for a whole range of purposes. Everything from everybody's favorite cat memes, which I will admit are an important part of my Facebook feed, so I thought that I'd put that up there. So everything from our cat memes to pictures of ourselves on holiday, me and the bridge a couple of weeks ago, to slightly more serious things, So disseminating information about how to prepare for a hurricane, for example, that's been very important in the last few months. Social media is also used for activism, for campaigns, for social awareness campaigns. So a couple of weeks ago, there was this hashtag MeToo campaign on social media, where people were using Twitter and Facebook and other forms of social media to post about experiences of sexual harassment and sexual violence. And this really took off and went viral a couple of weeks ago. So this is another way that social media is used. And on a serious note, or even more serious, I should say, social media is very often used in conflict. And this social media in conflict is at the core of the argument for today, at the core of this paper and what I want to talk about. Now, again, just as social media is used in many different ways in our everyday lives, it's used in lots of different ways in conflict also. This, for example, is a picture that was circulated around April of this year following the chemical weapons attack in Syria back in April. It's also used to disseminate photos from Kenya, post-election violence, from Darfur, from the Ukraine, Burundi, and this is just an example if you Google Al-Fali. If you put Al-Fali's name into YouTube, you get an awful lot of results. There's so much social media content relating to conflict. Its use is very pervasive. And finally, a type of social media used in conflict, but we talk a little bit less about, is this idea of crisis mapping. So this is a screenshot of the crisis map that was operational during the Libyan conflict. I think this is a 2011 snapshot, if I'm remembering it right. The idea behind crisis mapping is that users on the ground can text information, or the map creators may gather information from social media, and they use that to plot events onto maps, so that you can go on and you can see in real time where attacks have taken place, where there might be checkpoints, where humanitarian aid might be needed, and so on and so forth. So this is the one for Libya that was used for the conflict. There was also, for example, a crisis map used in the aftermath of the earthquake in Haiti in 2010 to draw attention to where humanitarian aid was needed following the earthquake. So lots of different kinds of social media use in conflict. Now, to explore in our paper the different dimensions of this social media use in conflict, we developed three questions to look at. What are people doing with social media? What effect is this use of social media having? And what or who is this social media use having an effect on? So these are the three questions that we use to structure the paper, and it's the three questions that I'm going to use to structure the presentation also. And then at the end of the paper, and also at the end of the presentation, you can take a step back and look at the phenomenon as a whole through this lens of democratization. So we'll start with the first question. What are people doing with social media? Now, I think the easiest answer is also the most obvious in a way. People use social media to share information that is important to them, that they feel that the rest of the world should know about. Whether that's your holiday pictures that you want your friends to look at and feel jealous about, or whether on a much more serious note, that's images of children suffocating in the aftermath of a chemical weapons attack. In very different ways, these are different types of information that people deem to be important, and that we share because we want other people to know about. So this idea of sharing information because it's important rings true in the uses of social media and conflict also. So discussing what the people are doing with social media, of course, this begs the question of who are the people here? If this is the external actor that I'm positing exists, who are they? Who are the people? Now, this was, I admit, quite a challenging issue for the paper because so many different people use social media all over the world in so many different locations and for so many different purposes. So the ideas that we're working with at the moment is to sort of think about this in two ways. So firstly, that the users that we're looking at are individuals who are posting on social media, using social media, but who are not affiliated with the state institutional structure or with the institutional structure of international criminal justice. In other words, not somebody who's working for the government, not someone who's working for the ICC or another institution. Now, we did this because the people here are meant to be an external actor. That's how we're positioning them. And so if they were posting on behalf of the government, that would give them a different kind of status and they'd be operating on different set of ideas. So outside of the institutional structure of the state and of the ICJ infrastructure. But also, we think the way our thinking is to exclude people who are posting on the behalf of a party to a conflict. So the group pages of ISIS, for example. So we would, at the moment, exclude those who are understanding of people also. And then secondly, a way of thinking about this is that there are frontline social media users and what you might call backline social media users. So frontline would be people, as the term suggests, on the front line. So people on the ground in Syria, in Iraq, in conflict zones, who are snapping pictures, making videos, and uploading this to social media. And then interacting with this content on social media. The backline people are people like you and I, potentially, who sit behind our computers or our smartphones or so on and so forth, and interact with content. Maybe we share it, we might retweet it, maybe we collate the information in one space and analyze it and test for its authenticity and things like this. So all of these actors, all of these individuals would fall under the umbrella of the people as we're using it for this paper. Also, we could think about the idea of people acting together in groups, such as through NGOs. So that's something to think about going forward. So what are people doing on social media? Well, they're using it to post information which is important and they feel is important for other people to know about. Now, for the second question, what effect is this social media use having? Now, I want to actually pick up on a term that Chris used in his presentation just now, which is this idea of mobilization. So social media allows people, it gives people a platform to mobilize, to join together around a common idea or a common goal. It gives them a space that they might not otherwise have, particularly in conflict, where demonstrating on the street or holding mass demonstrations might not be an option. So it gives people this digital space to come together and coalesce around a common idea or a common goal. In this sense, I would argue that social media gives people a greater presence on the global stage, more influence in the global discourse on these issues. What it comes down to, I would argue, is it makes the people louder than they used to be. Because they're much harder to ignore if there's a viral campaign going on social media that's on everybody's phones and on everybody's computers. And in that sense, I want to come back to this Me Too campaign that I mentioned. Because then while I was looking, while I was preparing this presentation, this was going on, and I was checking the Twitter feed and making my presentation, checking the Twitter feed and so on. And these two tweets really stuck out to me as hammering home this point. So the idea behind this hashtag MeToo campaign was for women and men and people who've experienced sexual harassment and sexual violence to use social media as a way to illustrate how big the problem is. Now, these tweets basically say, you know, we've been telling you about this for years, we've been trying to raise this issue, now that we have this hashtag MeToo campaign going, do you hear us now? And I think that really makes the point. Do you see us? Do you finally hear us? Now that there's so many of us using this online platform to join our voices together in this huge digital space, can you hear us now? So what effect is this social media use having? It's making the people louder. It's giving them more space and making them much harder to ignore. Now what or who is this social media use having an effect on? So we would argue that this social media use is having an effect on power dynamics operating in international criminal justice. Now, when we're talking about power, we've adopted a definition derived from Weber's definition of power, which is the probability of being able to carry out one's will despite resistance, or the capacity to produce intended effects on the behavior of others. And it's really on the second part that we focus. So we produce intended effects on the behavior of others. hopefully what we are exploring in the paper, what is particularly fascinating about social media use in conflict, is this idea that it may be having an effect on the behavior of the ICC prosecutor. Now, of course, there are other ICC actors and ICJ actors that may be involved here as well, that they may be having effects on, but for the purposes of the paper and the presentation, I'm just going to talk about the ICC prosecutor. So is social media use having an effect on the behavior of the prosecutor? Is it influencing the way that the prosecutor uses her discretion? Now, you can talk about this in different ways, possibly in situation selection, for example, but we, for the paper, looked at case selection. Is it influencing the cases that she's choosing to prosecute? Now, I have a few points of what I'm going to call support, because evidence, I think, here is the wrong word. So, a couple of points to support this theory that we have, and the points that actually led us to think about these ideas in the first place. Now, this basically comes down to the institutional capacity that the ICC is seeking to build in response to social media use and in actual case selection. In cases that have been selected by the prosecutor in the last few years and how social media use played a role in them. So I'll just go through those two things. So on the one hand, you really see that the ICC, Office of the Prosecutor, is seeking to build capacity to deal with this increase in social media use. There's been a number of micro innovations over the last few years that you can decipher from the policy documents and the budget documents coming out of the court. So, for example, they've established a cyber unit within the OTP, the Investigations Division. There is now a technology advisory board within the court. And that technology advisory board, for example, is currently working on guidelines for how to use open source social media evidence in international criminal trials at the court. So they're clearly taking this very seriously. So there's a technology advisory board. There are cyber investigators who've been hired to do cyber investigation work. And I know of at least one special ICC investigator whose focus is on open source material. So the type of material that you find on social media. And one thing that I particularly like to highlight that we came across in the documents was this crime pattern analysis unit. So this unit, from the documents, its role is to monitor ongoing situations before the court and monitor ongoing crime or new crime within those situations. And one of the ways that they monitor this is by looking at open source materials, including explicitly social media. This crime pattern analysis unit then has an advisory role with the ICC prosecutor and advises the prosecutor on case selection. So there's potentially a very direct relationship here between the type of content that's on social media and the advice being given to the prosecutor in terms of which cases to select. Now, in terms of actual case examples, I want to talk about the Al-Fahli arrest warrant. So Al-Fahli, the arrest warrant for Al-Fahli was issued in August of this year. It's the first ICC arrest warrant that makes explicit reference in the arrest warrant itself to social media content, and which is relying in great part on this social media content. It forms, in many ways, the core of the arrest warrant. It's not the only source of evidence in the arrest warrant, but it's really at the core of the arrest warrant. And these are just a couple of the screenshots of the videos that were posted to YouTube, although, as you can see, this one on the right is now on a different site because it was taken down. That's a whole other debate about taking this material down from social media. But we can cover that another time. So these are just a couple of screenshots, and it just shows you that this information is easily accessible to everybody. So I was able to go on a couple of clicks, and I can access this material. So the social media content is clearly making its way to the prosecutor and to the judges and into arrest warrants and into materials before the ICC. Now, a different situation, a much older one, related to Gaddafi Senior, Gaddafi Junior, and Al-Zanussi. So when the OTP requested the arrest warrants in those cases, in the annex to the request warrant arrest, right, so not in the arrest warrant, not in the request for the arrest warrant, but in the annex to, it's quite far removed, I know, but I still think it's relevant. There's quite a few references to YouTube videos, such as this one that I've taken a screenshot of. There's also excerpts from blogs. So this is itself a blog, this is an image that they've taken from Twitter, and this is actually an image of the Libya crisis map that I mentioned earlier. So all of this is in the material which led to the issuance of the arrest warrant, that was supported the request for the arrest warrant. And this is perhaps quite far removed from there being any what you might call direct connection, but I thought I'd put it in there anyway. So the first real crisis map came about during the post-election violence in Kenya. It's called the Ushahidi map, and Ushahidi stuff apparently translates to testimony in Swahili. And this was the first real crisis map that mapped the violence that was ongoing during the post-election violence in Kenya. There are anecdotal stories that suggest that there was a connection between this crisis map and the arrest warrants issued in the Kenya situation, but they are anecdotal and that is all they are, just to be 100% transparent. Now, my point with all of this is that social media is clearly making its way into the evidence being put before the court. It's clearly having some kind of role here that really needs attention, that really needs exploring. So when we ask what or who is this social media use having an effect on, well, we propose that it's at the very least a possibility, but possibly a likelihood that it's having an effect on the way that the ICC prosecutor is exercising her discretion when it comes to selecting cases for prosecution. Now, with all of this in mind, I think it's good to take a step back and to look at this phenomenon as a whole through the lens of democratization of international criminal justice. Now, the core of this, what I call the lens of democratization, is the idea that social media gives people the tools to participate in international criminal justice more actively and more effectively than they have been able to do in the past. Now, when we look at writings on democracy and democratization, there's a number of useful ideas that come up for looking at this phenomenon of social media use in conflict. One of these ideas that I think is particularly useful is the notion of consultation. So when we normally think about consultation in democratic ideas, we think of voting for elected officials, we think of referenda, and that's all true. But I think that we can see social media through this consultation lens as well. But before I get to that, just to sort of link this consultation idea more closely with this democracy, well, to fully more fully explain this consultation idea. So in democracy writings, you see this idea that democratization can be described as the movement towards a broader, more equal, more protected, a more binding form of consultation between citizens and the state. And the one way to judge the degree of democracy in a system of governance is to examine the extent to which the behavior of the state conforms to the views of the citizens as expressed through consultation. So if we think about looking at social media as a form of consultation, we can think about it as a way of looking at the collective preferences potentially being expressed through social media. Perhaps people in conflict are expressing a desire for a particular person to be indicted, for a particular armed group to be the focus of an investigation, for a particular person to be selected for prosecution, or a particular event to be investigated. You see this quite a lot in social media use in conflict, that the people on the ground are calling for action from the West or from the court. They're calling, and you saw this really quite poignantly during the fall of Aleppo. If anyone followed that on Twitter, it was awful. With people expressing their hopelessness and their desire for the world to help them as they were trapped in Aleppo as the Syrian army approached. So we can perhaps see this social media use as an expression of collective will, of preferences, of a desire for policy to go one way or another, for international criminal justice to focus on one thing or another. Now, of course, it should go without saying that I'm not suggesting that the ICC is the same as the state. It's certainly not. And many of the ideas that we see in writings about democracy, ideas about democracy, are quite citizen-state specific, and in that sense are particularly useful. But I do think that there's an added value to looking at this social media using conflict through this democratization lens, because it captures, I think, this process of diffusion away from this centralized prosecutor in The Hague to what might be described as an army of prosecutors on the front line on the ground who are taking social media and using that as their tool. But whenever we talk about democratization or any kind of process like this, we always must bring up the fact that democratization and these kinds of processes are not going to be equal. And just because you're listening to social media and you're listening to people through social media, it doesn't mean that you're hearing everybody. It means that you're hearing the people with access to the hardware, so smartphones and tablets and laptops. You're listening to the people who have access to the internet, to Wi-Fi, to data networks. You're listening to people who are technologically literate. And more basic than that, you're listening to people who are literate, which is certainly not going to be the case for everybody in conflict. So as we move forward with social media in conflict and try to understand how the social media use may be changing how international criminal justice works, we really need to bear in mind that there are definite downfalls and drawbacks to this way of approaching the sort of will of the people, so to speak. And that's where this idea of the digital divide comes in. So focusing too much on social media may entrench divides that already exist in society, and that's certainly a danger that we should be aware of. And just a further complication that I have to add in terms of this democratization narrative that I'm putting forward, is that Al-Fali doesn't actually fit into my story, that Al-Fali arrests Warren, because the social media content and the videos used in that arrest warrant were posted by the armed group itself. So not, that wouldn't count under my understanding of the people, right? And while that's true, I do still think it's valuable because it shows that social media content can have this effect and lead to the issuance of an arrest warrant when otherwise you might not have gotten that arrest warrant because that evidence wasn't available. So even though it doesn't quite fit the narrative, the next one might, or the one after. So it's still a very useful case to think about, I think. Now, to come to a quick conclusion then, social media and conflict isn't going anywhere. Every day that goes by, there's more and more content. And it's very important to how people are choosing to communicate about what is happening in conflict. And in fact, we have organizations and NGOs and intergovernmental organizations that are promoting this. Please, yes, by all means, pick up the phone and go and make a video so that we know what's going on. Well, that's great, but unless we are responsible in addressing how that material will be used, you could be sending people out to report information, putting their lives at risk to do so, when ultimately that information, at least for legal accountability purposes, will be useless. Because we haven't thought through beforehand what kind of role this material is going to play and how we're going to approach it. So as social media use becomes more and more important, these are questions that are becoming more and more pressing. And just to leave it on a very unsatisfactory note, which I hate when other people do it, so I'm sorry, this is an incredibly complex topic, and I didn't realize that when I started to look at it, just how many different angles there were to it. Which is why I said at the beginning that this is just a sketching of a conceptual and theoretical framework through which to begin to examine these issues. Because it's incredibly complex, there's many different angles to look at, and we're only just beginning to scratch the surface. And personally, I look forward to continue working in this field. I find it very fascinating, and I think that there's a lot to do and a lot to say. And I'm definitely keen to hear any feedback or any thoughts that you might have on where this research might go. So thank you very much for all your attention.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.